Hey, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix. I'm your host, Cedric Jungelman. I've already ditched traditional health insurance, and I just signed up my entire family for CrowdHealth. Why? Because CrowdHealth isn't about profits. It's about people. You get real support, a team that negotiates your bills, super low-cost prescriptions and labs, and access to doctors who actually treat you like a human. If something big happens, you cover the first 500. Then the community steps in to share the rest. Thousands of members have saved tens of thousands compared to old school insurance. With subsidies ending and costs skyrocketing, now's the time to take charge of your healthcare the smart way. Simple, direct, and community powered. This open enrollment, don't just sign up because you're told to. Choose to opt out of the broken system and join a movement that actually has your back. Join me and my family. Get started today for just $99 per month for your first 3 months using promo code MATRIX at joincrowdhealth.com. CrowdHealth, not insurance. Take your power back. This is how we win. Why don't you kick off 2026 with pure Bitcoin focus at a stunning new oceanfront Four Seasons venue with big-time legendary speakers like Natalie Brunel, Lawrence Lepard, and Dr. Sean Baker at the 4th annual Bitcoin Day Naples. High signal talks on sound money, mining, and macro, plus elite networking with 250 plus serious Bitcoiners and me in paradise. Saturday, January 17th, with an exclusive carnivore dinner the night before. Tickets are moving fast. Secure yours now and join the movement. Use promo code MATRIX for 10% off any ticket type, including an exclusive carnivore dinner with Dr. Sean Baker at a private residence in Naples. Grab your spot at bitcoinday.io with code MATRIX before it's too late. Last year, I partnered with Microseed because this is the best damn seed storage I have seen in 8+ years of being in the Bitcoin space. They supply titanium, stainless steel, and nylon washers. Imagine storing your seed phrase on nylon short-term to get through body scanners, x-rays, and metal detectors. Imagine stamping the words so small they are nearly invisible to the human eye. Microseed engraves your entire Bitcoin seed phrase on a fireproof, waterproof steel or titanium washer the size of a dime. Discreet, resilient seed security made simple. Use the code MATRIX for a discount at microseed.io. The Bitcoin Matrix is a self-supported podcast, so please consider supporting us directly via PayPal, Venmo, Bitcoin on Strike, check, or money order. Also, please consider supporting the show directly by subscribing to the Bitcoin Matrix on the Fountain app to get early, ad-free access to every new episode. Please see the show notes for the links. Thanks for tuning in to the Bitcoin Matrix. Please make sure to like and subscribe to the show. Write a 5-star review, share your favorite episodes with your friends and family to help spread the word. And definitely check out our new website, thebitcoinmatrix.com, where you can sign up for our upcoming newsletter, connect with me directly, and buy fresh and dope Bitcoin Matrix merchandise like hats, mugs, and t-shirts. If you didn't already know, I co-host a live show every Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern with Paul Tarantino called Bitcoin Center, where the debate is the story. Tune in for the laughs and jokes. In this episode of The Bitcoin Matrix, I chat with Lauren Rodriguez, wife of Keone Rodriguez, co-founder of the privacy-focused Bitcoin Samurai Wallet, about her family's harrowing journey through the U.S. justice system. Keone was indicted by the DOJ and sentenced to 5 years in federal prison for developing non-custodial Bitcoin privacy tools. Lauren walks us through the shocking pre-dawn FBI raid, the trial that never happened, the political motivations behind the charges, and the personal toll of what she believes is a deeply unjust prosecution. We dive into the philosophical fight for privacy, the role of open source software, and the chilling effect this case could have on developers everywhere. If you care about privacy, Bitcoin, financial freedom, or due process, this conversation is for you. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Lauren Rodriguez.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Lauren, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, and thank you for taking the time to join us. How are you?
Hi, Cedric. Thank you so much for having me on. I am doing all right, all things considered.
Sure. Yeah, I wish we were speaking under better circumstances, and I do remain very optimistic. I mean, I really think that Keone and Bill are political prisoners and have been persecuted on, well, I think they're innocent. But I think sort of the persecution has been sort of politically motivated, at least by certain factions. But I think maybe the best place to start would be the raid. And if you could just sort of, what was that day like?
So it was April 24th, 2024, and we were asleep and our dog started barking. And it's about 5 a.m., so still dark out, April in Pennsylvania. It's, you know, cold, dark, and it was unusual. So woke us up. Both up, and we were kind of startled. And Keone went over to the window, and there was a light kind of rising on that side of the house. It's a small cottage house, but on that side, it's three stories. And it was unusual to see a light moving up towards the window. And at that moment, it was, you know, I guess chaos broke out. There was a loudspeaker repeating his name, saying, you know, come out with your hands up. And I guess instinct took over, and I was, you know, worried about my dog. So we came downstairs, and, you know, you're groggy and not quite sure what's going on or why this is happening. So as we, you know, come downstairs, and I get the dog on the leash, and we go out, and the house is surrounded, and there's laser sights on our chest, and there's an MRAP armored vehicle, and you know, you could kind of see night vision goggle glow and just people everywhere. And again, we live in a very small rural town. So just shocking. And at that point, I'm handcuffed. Keone is told to get down on his knees and he is handcuffed and he's led away and put into a car. We're separated. I'm passed over to a local officer. I see them fly a drone into our house. Not sure why, but they do that. I asked the officer that told me, what is this about? Why, you know, what's going on? And he said, I don't know. They showed up and I'm supposed to be off shift. And that's all I knew for a while as I stood out in the cold in my pajamas, handcuffed. And then eventually they brought me back into the house and pretty much kindly told me that I should leave the premises of my own home. I wasn't able to speak with Keone, but I was allowed to leave. And I came back, you know, I called the company's attorney in shock, wasn't sure what was going on. He's in a different time zone. So, you know, woke him up. And thankfully, he was able to get the ball rolling and trying to find some kind of counsel to, because we still weren't really sure what was going on. The indictment was sealed. So they wouldn't tell us. And they wouldn't, it's not like, I thought if someone showed up to your house, they'd just show you a warrant. That's not the case. It wasn't until later, and then they showed it to Keone when he had a public defender in Pittsburgh. And thankfully, I was able to pick him up from the courthouse that night. But at the same time that this was going on, which we didn't find out for a bit, his business partner, Bill, was being a simultaneous raid in Portugal. So just the coordination and the money that went into, you know, multinational coordinated raid. It's just, yeah, beggar's belief.
How would you describe your husband's business?
So they were, you know, Samurai Wallet was started in around 2015. And, you know, it was a full Bitcoin wallet, a batch 32 Bitcoin wallet. So, you know, similar to a lot of wallets out there, the kind of special thing about them was they had some added features that were privacy related. Everything was non-custodial, kept, you know, control of your keys at all times, all the good practices, you know, as a Bitcoiner that you would want to have in a wallet. The two, and there was many features, privacy related features that the government didn't have problems with, but the two that they did have a problem with were a feature called Ricochet, which allowed users to programmatically add additional transactional hops automatically, instead of having to wait for a transaction to confirm and send again, wait for a transaction to confirm and send again. So that's what Ricochet did. And the other issue, or the other feature that they had an issue with was Whirlpool. Whirlpool was Samurai Wallet's, what they developed as their CoinJoin implementation. And this Whirlpool was not just available in Samurai Wallet, it was also available in Sparrow Wallet and one other wallet actively, but there were some other wallets that were, I guess, looking into implementing it as well. So it was in three wallets. Yeah, Samurai had developed it. So those were what the wallet was.
So coming out of the raid, I mean, the next couple of days, I mean, how are you processing this? Did you guys get to coordinate or speak with Bill? None of this sounds like a normal response or way to, I mean, were you guys, was Bill or Keone expecting any legal issues? Were any of this sort of like expected? Because this is quite the amount of, like you were saying, global coordination, manpower expense, very scary.
It was very scary. And to be honest, a lot of it, like thinking, I don't know if I just shut down autopilot function, but I think I must have, because like, it's not, you know, all totally clear. But there was no inkling that something like this was going to happen. So the US government never contacted them. I mean, they had a known lawyer, but they also had, you know, support desks and stuff where some, you know, if the government could have contacted either for help, for clarification, or for, there's something called a spoilation letter. So if you are under investigation, this is depicted in movies and stuff, but the government will send you a letter that says, hey, don't destroy anything because we're looking into you. And that's like kind of a common practice, especially for, I'm assuming banks get these a lot and, you know, those kind of businesses, but that's not how we were treated, right? The raid and the, just the all out kind of force that they used just seems so unproportional to what the charges were. And I mean, I don't even know what my neighbors must have been thinking, right? To see the whole town filled with armed HRT FBI agents. So no idea that this was coming. This was our first interaction with law enforcement in any way.
Wow. So bizarre that the things played out that way. And the amount of force is astonishing for even the things that are being accused here. Which I don't think Keone's guilty of. But how did you and Keone meet? Did you who found Bitcoin first?
So we were together before Bitcoin. We met in Chicago, and I think had probably heard of it, but was very much into, you know, gold and silver and kind of that way, which I guess is finally, you know, silver's finally up again from when we were kind of doing that and the whole coins going through, getting rolls and looking for the silver coin. So like kind of did that stuff. But then he found Bitcoin and really kind of saw what it could be and saw, you know, the potential not only in the limited supply and value there, but also in the, you know, can't be confiscated, the real freedom behind it, to be able to support causes without someone telling you no. Because right back when he got it, I think it was about 2013, WikiLeaks was a big thing, and being able to donate when Visa and MasterCard said no. So actually still having a way to support causes, you know, variety of causes. And more recently, we saw that with the Canadian truckers during COVID. So it's kind of similar cycles that come around. And so, yeah, he saw the value in it and I kind of went along for the ride, right? I think most kind of Bitcoin spouses will probably, you end up knowing a lot about it as well, just from the passion that people do have for Bitcoin.
Yeah, maybe you could describe your journey as the wife of a Bitcoiner. I mean, did it take years before you even tuned in to what he was talking about? Did you think at first this was another a crazy hobby of his, or when did you know it was more for him?
He got very passionate very quickly, and like I got it too. He's really good at explaining it, and I kind of come from a more libertarian ideologies anyways, so I definitely was bought in as well. I don't have the technical skills to do to do any kind of coding or anything like that with it, but I do understand it. And, you know, I was able to do kind of while he started working for Bitcoin companies, I kind of did some side things as well and was actually earning Bitcoin, had my own wallet, you know, back in the day as well. So it was always fun, you know, buying coffee, buying things with it. That's, you know, I like to shop. So back then, yeah, that was a big selling feature to me that I could do that. So yeah, but I've been kind of right along and in the space with him, just not in any kind of functional way, I guess.
Sure. So maybe you said it sounds like you were primed for Bitcoin, but Bitcoin can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. It could be just number go up. It's not even for most Bitcoiners, is it about privacy and custody? So when did you, or how was it that you started to get it more than just this is an investment or trade, or did you always see it as sort of revolutionary money?
I think Keone always saw it that way. And there was, so he was earning his salary. We were living off of Bitcoin since 2015. So there was a lot of times where, you know, he would get paid on the first. And by the time we went to get groceries, pay rent, that kind of stuff, it was lower. So when you're kind of in that environment where you're spending, I guess, more of the value than you were paying in it, then I think it does kind of change your perspective a little bit on, yes, it's going to go up in the long run, but this really has a utility and can bring freedom. A lot of the users of Samurai Wallet were in, you know, were kind of, right, freedom fighters in Iran or people in Bolivia who, you know, they need this technology that they were providing for their safety, for freedom, for, you know, all these other causes in addition to the financial security that Bitcoin can provide.
Sure. Maybe you could describe more of the community or the users or his interactions, him and Bill, with their users and what privacy meant to them and all of you, because you know, it's more than just a wallet, and there's this sort of a cause here around privacy, and I'm not sure it's fully. I think this is the fight that is ahead of us still, and that we're in, obviously. So, what was that sort of like? What kind of feedback would you get from users?
So they would always say, you know, they built the wallet and the functionality that they wanted to use themselves, and a big part of that was, I guess, looking. I mean, Keone was very into history. I guess that's just kind of, yeah, that's what he liked. And so I think a lot of it was seeing how there can become a need for privacy. His father had to fled Cuba as a child under when Castro came into power. And if people are familiar with that, like a lot of people, you know, completely life savings wiped out if you were lucky enough to get out and not thrown in prison as a political prisoner. So I think that probably did influence him a lot in knowing that this stuff does happen and it can happen quickly. And, you know, we're very fortunate overall in the West that, you know, we're seeing rights being eroded, but we're still pretty free and, you know, can get by. But it can change and it can change quickly. And so their thing was to have the tools available for when you would need it. And yeah, they still are out there, thankfully. You know, they did shut down Samurai Wallet, but because it was free and open source software, there's another team that has picked it up and it's still running. Also, if you were running your own node, you know, you weren't affected except for the Whirlpool service is no longer available. So.
Health insurance is broken. I know it, you know it. So when open enrollment rolls around and all those health insurance companies start hoping you'll just re-sign, eyes closed, for the same overpriced plan with confusing fine print, it feels like they're betting on your inaction. But we deserve better than that. That's why I started looking for something different for me and my family. Something honest. That's when I found CrowdHealth. With CrowdHealth, it's not about profits. It's about people and community. You get a team that helps negotiate your bills, access to low-cost prescriptions and lab tests, and a list of doctors who don't treat you like a number. And if something major happens, you cover the first $500. Then the crowd steps in to help share the rest. It feels real. It feels like taking care of your health the way it should be. Simple, direct, and human. Thousands of members already say CrowdHealth saved them tens of thousands of dollars over traditional insurance. And with many subsidy programs ending and costs rising, there's never been a more important time to take charge of your healthcare. So this open enrollment, don't sign because you're told to. Sign because you choose to. If you're ready to join a community that looks out for you, give CrowdHealth a try. Join CrowdHealth to get started today for $99 for your first 3 months using code MATRIX at joincrowdhealth.com. CrowdHealth is not insurance. Opt out. Take your power back. This is how we win.
Maybe going now from the raid to the trial, I believe, you know, people and coders that are working on tools for privacy and self-custody are freedom fighters. And, you know, depending on your ability to remain anonymous, there's personal risk. And so maybe we could talk about the trial. And, you know, you start maybe in the trial thinking we're on solid ground here. Maybe we could describe like maybe the what you were thinking going into the trial as a team and then how that developed.
Yeah. So going into it, we were very confident. You know, we knew that, right, these are conspiracy charges. And with conspiracy charges, they're supposed to prove that these two parties conspired to commit a crime. And that didn't happen. So we're like, okay, like we can prove this. They're confused. They don't understand the technology. We'll be able to explain it. You know, we'll be able to explain it. They'll see that, well, we didn't have custody, so we couldn't have been conspiring to, you know, operate an unlicensed money service business. We weren't a money service business because we didn't have custody of people's funds. That's kind of par for the course of being a money service business. And, you know, they never conspired with any criminals to launder money. In fact, the service was designed, Whirlpool was designed in a way that was almost a deterrent to money launderers, because if you've stolen money and want to move, you know, you want to move quickly so you can get it and cash out, and, you know, they're not interested in holding on to Bitcoin for a long period of time and going through the slow process, which is what Whirlpool was. And that's how it's designed to function, was to move slowly and you get more anonymity that way. So we're like, oh, you know, this is going to be fine. And then, you know, we saw the evidence that they had, and it was all, you know, purposefully misinterpreting or, you know, leaving out of context of, you know, tweets and these other messages where, you know, you're getting a clip this big out of thousands of messages. And then on top of that, you know, Keone had done 10 years of podcasts and long form writing of explaining, this is why we're building the software. This is what it's for. This is why privacy matters to law abiding people. And then, yeah, then the trial kind of went downhill from there. Again, not trial, but the court case.
Maybe in your words, why does privacy matter to law abiding people?
So that's, I guess I'm actually a pretty private person by nature. Like, this is my first kind of foray into any kind of public speaking. I didn't have, you know, I had a private X account before this. Like, I'm not on social media. No, now I am due to this. But it's not about hiding everything. It's about, you know, selectively disclosing. And we all do this, whether we admit, you know, I have nothing to hide, or, you know, those phrases that people use. But we do. It's I don't know. I think it's kind of almost a sense of identity of, you let people in that when they earn it, or, you know, different things like that. Like, we have blinds on our windows, locks on our doors, you know, bathroom stalls have a door, like just things that there's something sacred, I think, about who you allow in, and financial privacy even more so due to, you know, our money tells us, I guess, how you spend your money tells so much about you, whether, you know, what kind of charities you support or political parties or, you know, your religious affiliation, or, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of things people spend money on that they wouldn't want people in their lives to know about. Legal, you know, things that are perfectly legal. And there can be real consequences if things get out. I guess, you know, if you work for a company that's very liberal and you happen to donate to Republican causes, we've seen that, right? We've seen people lose jobs over such things. So yeah, that's that's my selling on privacy.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I feel I'm an incredibly private person. I wouldn't want people. It's already frustrating how much leakage there is in the things we do with our money. And I would not, I don't, you know, like when you use your credit card, they could gleam your home address or different things like this. And it's just not necessary. And I wouldn't want it, you know, and I think about voting and the ability, you know, with financial surveillance and CBDCs, it's very Orwellian when centralized forces know and can piece together different databases and just figure out everything about you from your spending habits.
And it's even more so than centralized forces, right? There with the Bitcoin blockchain, it being so public, your barista at Starbucks who, you know, maybe messed up your latte and so you only tipped her 5% can now know your entire net worth and also probably knows your address and, you know, from a data leak. And it's people have been put at physical risk and have unfortunately had physical harm done to them due to this public nature of the blockchain. So,
yeah. And that's why there's so much more work that needs to be done. I wish the best minds in Bitcoin weren't working on stable coins and tokenized assets. And they were helping us first to secure our sats and to make it real money in terms of like cash and how private cash is hand to hand.
And unfortunately, you know, cases like my husband's is going to have a real deterrence on people being willing to do this kind of development. That is much needed, like you said.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's already a chill and I couldn't imagine. I think it's so scary, I think, for developers. And I think it just it doesn't make it easier if you have to be anonymous to be a developer. And there could be a lot of pros. I think there's a tremendous amount of pros to anonymity and whether you're a developer or anything. Maybe you just want to, you could share different, not different opinions, but there's a freedom to sort of anonymity online. So what was the trial like? Did you feel as, you know, an American citizen that the justice system was fair? You were getting a fair shot that Samurai was.
Well, it didn't go to trial, but so the court case, it's been about a year. So it was April 24th is when we were raided. And I think that was probably one of the biggest shocks is how slow the justice system moves. And so there's, I think it was five or seven terabytes of discovery produced by the government in this case. And as Bill's lead defense attorney said, if you would print that out on paper, it would go to the moon and back 22 times. So this is an immense amount of data that had to be sorted through by lawyers because, you know, the prosecution doesn't give you a little file saying, here's all of our evidence we're going to use. No, you have to go through every single piece, which obviously takes time, takes money. And so that was months and months of work. And then through that discovery, our attorney thought to ask the prosecution if they had ever had a conversation with FinCEN. And FinCEN is the Financial Enforcement and Crime Network regulator. And their job is to regulate money service businesses and illicit finance. And they put out guidance. They did one in 2013 and then again in 2019. And that's the guidance that everyone in the industry had been following as to who needs to get a license and who doesn't. So and the kind of understanding of that was, if you're a custodian, if you hold people's money, you know, people are able to buy and sell Bitcoin through your services, then you need a money service business license. There was even a specific in the 2019 regulation that mentioned non-custodial anonymizing software providers, which is what Whirlpool would have fallen under. And it says, as long as you don't take custody, you're fine. You don't need a license. So our attorney asked the prosecution, have you had any communications with them about, you know, our client Samurai Wallet? And they said, oh, in fact, we did. We did have some communications. we spoke with them 6 months before we indicted. And in this, you know, this letter, they said, no, if they don't take custody, we don't think they need a license. And they had hidden this from us. This was a year into the case. And that's what's known as a Brady violation. It's exculpatory evidence that they hid. And that's something that they definitely should have given over. So that was, you know, we're like, this is it, right? They're going to dismiss the case. On top of that, there's something called a motion to dismiss. And motion to dismiss takes the indictment as fact. So you're not arguing the facts of the indictment. You're just saying, even if all of this is true, which, you know, it's not, but even if all this is true, due to the law, the way the, you know, the letter of the law, you cannot, you know, this cannot be a conviction. They didn't break the law. And so we spent, you know, a year and a half preparing all this to go before the judge. And our judge at the time was Judge Berman. A few days, I think it was 3-4 days, something like that, before we're going to make, you know, arguments, oral arguments on the motion to dismiss, on the Brady violation to see, you know, is he going to do anything about this? And there were some other things, amicus briefs, which are, you know, industry participants will write advising the court. It's called, you know, it's known as friend of the court letters. So there's a bunch of things that this is going to be our big push before Judge Berman. A few days before we're going there, the judge gets changed. We don't know why, still don't know why. And our new judge is Denise Coate. She was the former head prosecutor in the criminal division of SDNY. And those are the prosecutors that were bringing charges against us. And our first appearance in front of her, she comes out and she says, I'm denying all of these motions and thank you, goodbye. Pretty much as, you know, she gave no explanation as to why she was denying our motions, either orally or in writing. And we were stunned. Our attorneys were stunned. You know, they were prepared to be arguing our case as to, you know, why it should be dismissed and why she needs to hold the prosecution accountable for breaking the rules of the court and you know, violating Brady. And, you know, it was maybe a 10-minute conference in front of her. And at that point, we realized this isn't going to go well. There's no justice to be had here. It's really disheartening. Right? You think, especially, you know, you learn in school that America's criminal justice system is the best in the world. And I'm sure in a lot, you know, what it's founded on, it is. But in practice, in the federal system, at least the way we've experienced it, it wasn't. It, you know, we had lies, manipulations, and a judge acting as the fifth prosecutor from the bench. So that's really where kind of our whole thoughts about taking this to trial changed.
Right. When was that, this moment with the judge?
I'm not 100%. I think it was October. Maybe it may have been earlier. I don't have that exact date.
2024
or? No, 2025. So we were about a year and a half, you know, or a year plus into preparing all those motions and, you know, millions of dollars into preparing all these motions and for her to go, nah, denied.
Right. And yeah. Were you in New York?
Yeah, I attended every conference, every attorney meeting I was present for. I wanted to be there to support Keone.
And so why was this in New York? Why is the SDNY, the nickname is Sovereign District of New York, I guess, but why are they presiding over this?
That's a good question. So Samurai was blockchain only. They didn't have any bank account, any fiat bank accounts. They didn't do business in New York. Keone hadn't been to New York in years. But apparently, the way that they get jurisdiction in cases like this is an FBI agent downloaded Samurai Wallet off of Google Play, walked down onto the streets of Manhattan, and made a Bitcoin transaction. And that's all it takes for them to say, we have jurisdiction. So simple as that.
And then I guess at some point between October and now there was a plea?
Yeah. So after our first appearance in front of Judge Coate, we had pretty frank discussion with our attorneys and they kind of informed us of, and you know, some other people as well, that, you know, she had a reputation. She was a no nonsense, kind of pro prosecution. She's, if you are convicted, she will give you the max, and, you know, with a smile. And at that, and also the fact that we probably would not be able to present a defense of, you know, advice of counsel or kind of a lot of other things. She just wasn't going to allow. I think a lot of people maybe don't realize the power that a judge has in a courtroom. So it's not just, oh, you go in front of the jury and present your case. There's so many steps beforehand, and the judge decides, you know, what evidence the jury is going to be allowed to hear, what kind of experts you can put on the stand, what even theory of defense you're allowed to present, down to in Roman Storm's case in the same Southern District of New York. I think their judge, Fela, she kind of put stipulations on words. So I don't think they were allowed to use the word privacy. So like there's so much that they are, a judge is the king or queen of their courtroom. So they really do control what happens, and they do control the outcome in a way. It really depends on your judge, whether you win or lose a case. There is one, and I don't recall what the case was, but fairly recently that went to kind of in front of two different judges, and, you know, one judge they lost in front of, the other one they won. So it really is that arbitrary. So at that point, once we had those discussions, the prosecution came to us and they gave us 24 hours. So you have, you know, here's the plea. We will drop the conspiracy to commit money laundering if you plead to conspiracy to operate an unlicensed money service business, and it's like a subsection of that. You have 24 hours and you both have to agree. If one of you agrees and the other one doesn't, deal's off the table. If you don't, and we go to court and you lose, we are going to go after you for the full, you know, I think it's $248 million. That's the amount that they say was transacted through Whirlpool. But again, they know how this, the software works. They know that they never had this money. So they said, well, if you pay us all the fees that you made while operating the business over 10 years, if you pay us those fees, we'll say that's, you know, good. And we won't go after you for this additional funds that we know you've never had. And it was tough. It was, you know, a really tough decision to have to, you know, agree to something that, you know, you didn't do, you know, there was no intent behind. And there was a lot of back and forth with, you know, Keone and his allocution, because if you are pleading, you have to stand up and say what you did, and the court has to accept that. And, you know, he was able to word it in a way that he wasn't lying. That was a really big thing for him. He's like, I will not get up and lie in court. So he got up and said, you know, I operated and, you know, I developed, operated, and maintained Samurai Wallet, which users used to, you know, transact Bitcoin. And, you know, knowing that users could, the Bitcoin could be from criminal proceeds, something along those lines. But, you know, it was very clear in that it was the users that were doing the transacting, and the court accepted that. So that's what he pled to. And at sentencing, so you do the plea, and then it's a few months, and then you go for sentencing. And at sentencing, she just clearly did not like him, did not like that he had libertarian kind of ideologies, and threw the book at him. So she, with the plea, the max she could do was 5 years, and the max fine she could do was $250,000. Both of those are more than pre-sentencing report. They kind of do something and look and kind of calculate these things out. And pre-sentencing was, for both those numbers, was lower. And she went max out. And if she could have given him life, she would have given him life. And at that point, you know, any doubt, any kind of reticence we had about taking that plea wiped away. It was the right choice. Unfortunately, we were kind of backed into a corner where that was the only choice.
When it comes to Bitcoin, the rules are simple. Run your own node, hold your own keys, and protect your seed phrase. That's where Microseed comes in.
Unlike bulky backups, MicroSeed is stamped onto a tiny steel washer. Fireproof, waterproof, and so small you can carry it anywhere or hide it in plain sight. Go to microseed.io and use the code MATRIX for a discount on your order.
Yeah, this is so unjust, it's disgusting. But I'm going to try to parse it out a little bit. So on one hand, you know, I've always feared the law because I know it's unjust or it's not going to be good to get involved, right? But I never really thought about it as like an American. You know, you like maybe you get into a car accident, it's not your fault, and like you're involved with the law, right? But here it sounds like, you know, if someone robs a bank, they're going to take the Ford family to jail because they made the car. And it's like, that's just not American. And like, I feel like this is not a good place to live if there's no law here. There's no justice. When I say law, I mean lawfulness or, you know, law that makes sense. And
yeah. Representative Warren Davis said it's like holding Microsoft responsible if a cartel would use Excel. And it's as simple as that. Like there's nothing kind of safe because criminals use everything, right? As you said, they use cars, they use the internet, they use VPNs. If a Bitcoin transaction, isn't actually a transaction until it's confirmed by a miner. So are miners now, you know, money service businesses? I hope not. That's a terrible precedent.
Yeah, yeah, I think this is scary. Horrendous precedent. I do think this points to miners are next, if not second in line, someone's next in line. This is to scare the shit out of coders, developers, innovators. Really, that's the thing. It's like the coding is just the tool to innovate. And what I'm still trying to like slice and dice here a bit is users can do bad things and say, okay, well, if users were doing money laundering, that's bad. But I think the notion of custody and or privacy being bad in and of itself, which is what I think the government's really after. When you said the judge didn't like his sort of libertarian leanings, or what did you mean by that?
She called it out in sentencing that due to that somehow because of his beliefs that equated to him thinking he was above the law. And it's like, no, we were following what the law was and what the whole industry was following. So yeah, the hostility and the vitriol that she was kind of spewing from the bench was shocking, but it shouldn't be that shocking when another judge was within that same courthouse, the same SDNY, made a comment that cryptocurrencies is good for nothing but criminals and scams. So this really is their opinion of, you know, an industry that millions of people use. And yeah, I don't know how you get past that, right? There doesn't seem to be any repercussions for them, at least yet. Hopefully that'll change, but currently.
Right. And SDNY, Southern District of New York, is also where Ross Ulbricht was prosecuted, I believe, and so was President Trump.
Yeah.
And I really believe Ross was unjustly persecuted and a political prisoner. And they really, I think, that with the sentencing, made an example of him. And I think also held back a lot of evidence and what was happening in parallel trials. And, when you start learning about how judges are appointed and what you're saying with the judge being changed at the last minute and then all the motions are not even heard or sort of explained, sort of really just feels incredibly frustrating. What was the reaction like, or how from the community? How has that been? I feel like word really started to break and people started to gain some sense of urgency when we got a lot more clarity. And I felt like came to it very late because I just didn't understand what was at stake. I think we all know the Bitcoin community can be quite immature at times. And there is no community, right? There's no group, but wherever people go to chit chat, right? Some of it could be really immature, and we can get involved in issues that get us sidetracked from important ones like this. But what has it been like?
So I think you say there's no community. I think there's a lot of little separate communities within the Bitcoin space, and kind of the privacy community, you know, if you will, and then users of Samurai Wallet and some other softwares were they knew about it from the start and were, had been very vocal, but it did take a while. And it took till after Keone could really come out and speak on his own behalf, because, you know, you're advised, like, don't say anything, and especially when a case is completely built off of them, you know, taking things out of context that you said, you know, you don't want to add any more fuel to their fire. So once sentencing was done, he was able to speak, and, you know, people like yourself and Bob from Bitcoin Veterans and just, you know, and Puncher and just all these people kind of came on board and heard about it and realized what was gone. It was really amazing kind of having that swell of support and seeing that other people got it, right? That it wasn't just, because it's such an, you know, I've spoken to other people that have had similar dealings. You know, they all seem to be conspiracy charges and this and that from the federal government. And it's a very isolating feeling when you're going against the power of the state. And so to have that support from, you know, I'll use community because from Bitcoiners, we'll say, has been really great. Just to know that people understand you, they believe you, they read the evidence themselves, and they've come to the same conclusion you have. It's validating, which is kind of needed.
Yeah, that I found. You know, this is one of those things where you know, just as a Bitcoiner, there's all these expressions: don't trust, verify. You know, things, validate for yourself, do your own research. But you have to put in the time. Fortunately, in a short amount of time, you can grok this. It takes a few minutes. It takes about probably 45 minutes to relearn the law or learn the law. And after about 25 minutes, you're like, holy shit, this is just kind of clear that they don't belong in prison. I don't think there's anything done wrong here at all. And it sounds like SDNY continues to go rogue. And the scary thing is the implications, obviously on a personal level for you, but for all of us. And I think this is global. I think sort of American law and precedent, and this is sort of like soft precedent where it's not legal precedent. But I think, you know, this is sort of, you know, very scary, I think. What was the process like of driving Keone to prison?
So that was hard. So that was another kind of one of the judges' last little digs she could get, is oftentimes between sentencing and, you know, if you're out on bail, you can do something called self-surrender. And oftentimes that'll take months because, again, bureaucracies move slowly. And once it's sent from the courts, you're sentenced, and it gets sent to the Bureau of Prisons, and they have to determine various things. You know, they try to keep you close to family, and, you know, what kind of, depending on if you're what level of security you need. If you're violent, obviously you need to go to a secure, high security prison, versus, you know, Keone, who's never had any interactions with the law, is nonviolent. So he was designated to a camp, and that process usually takes some time, but she gave us a little over a month from sentencing to, you need to report to your prison. And if you don't have a prison, you need to come back to New York and surrender, and you'll be put in the MDC, which is one of the worst jails in the country. Thankfully, we were able to get a designation, and driving down, I know it was weird. I think Keone mentioned this in a letter, that we kind of didn't focus on where we were going. We're big kind of road trippers in general. We just prefer to drive, and oftentimes we drive off highway. And so, and being kind of not able to go anywhere for so long, it almost felt very natural and comfortable in that, just, you know, sitting together in a car, because you just can talk and talk to about anything but going, that, you know, the destination. But it was hard. It was actually pulling up to the prison. We had to park in the visitor's parking lot, and he then had to walk away from me and walk to the prison. And, you know, I wasn't sure when I was going to be able to hear from him, because it takes a while for, like, you to get phone credits and just various things. And it's an unknown. And thankfully, once I did hear from him, you know, I heard he was okay. And that was really reassuring. But driving away and, you know, leaving you know, my best friend, my husband, my partner for, you know, 14 years. It was sad. It's hard.
Wow. Well, my heart goes out to you for dealing with all this. What can we do to sort of raise awareness and continue fighting? You know, Keone's is his own best advocate. And that's what was you mentioning. So difficult. He wasn't really able to probably speak for so long. And then he did an amazing job speaking under such probably what I can't imagine, such strenuous circumstances, speaking so eloquently and articulately and really explaining the situation so people can grok it very quickly. And then his voice kind of, I mean, he's gotten the letters out, but it's a bit silenced, you know. So what can we do to kind of keep his voice alive, but also keep the fight going?
Yeah, so there's a few things. And, you know, the first thing would be to sign the petition for a pardon. That's really what we're going for. When you do a plea deal, unless there's like constitutional grounds that you can do, you're signing away any options for appeals or anything like that. So really a pardon is our option, our best option, only option. And some people think, oh, signing a petition, what good does that do? But, you know, you mentioned Ross earlier, Lynn, his mother, and Ross himself both said that, you know, it really does matter. Every signature, when you can take it to, you know, the president or, you know, the president's kind of representatives and say, look, people care about this issue. This is going to be a popular choice. You know, they're asking for it. Other people see the injustice that was, you know, done here. So definitely sign. The other thing, if you're, you know, willing and able, court cases are very, very expensive. They took our life savings. We're massively in debt. Same with, you know, Bill and Sabrina, and with them being away. If people are willing to donate through the billandkeone.org, there's Bitcoin donation options, and as well as a Give, Send, Go. It, you know, really does go a long way. And then, you know, if anyone has any connections or just, you know, to keep raising awareness, whether or not be on X or writing to your, you know, senators or representatives, being courteous and respectful, right? We don't want to turn them against us, but letting them know, again, it's just another way to say, you know, this is a cause that matters to Bitcoiners, and you know, something we're willing to give our time and our voices to. If anyone would like to write to him, his address is also on the billandkeone.org website. He's received letters so far, and he's been writing back, and you know, I think it. You do feel so, you know, especially in this day and age, right, where we do have X and other social medias where you're constantly connected with people, to then be put in a space where they limit your amount of minutes you can have on the phone. They, you know, it's everything's very restricted and limited. And so just that connection to the outside world, and you know, it could just be sharing a funny story, or, you know, it doesn't have to be anything serious. But I know he'd appreciate that.
Yeah, we'll put the links in the show notes. I think The Rage is publishing his letters. I encourage people to read them. They're very well written, very insightful. A couple more just points I want to touch on before we roll out. So didn't Trump issue a letter or guidance to the DOJ in Washington?
Yeah, so the deputy AG, Todd Blanche, he wrote Trump's guidance, wrote a letter that said, we as the Department of Justice are no longer going to be prosecuting developers or, you know, manufacturers of software for the actions of the users. You need to go after the real criminals. And I think, I don't know, I agree with that. I think most Americans would, that you go after the criminal, you don't go after other people. That's, you know, self-responsibility and all that. And this was something that the prosecutors clearly were aware of, because they hemmed and hawed and tried to skirt their way around it and decided to drop. So what they dropped is what they're charged under was conspiracy under 1960. It's the money service business. And the first part that they dropped was operating a money service business without a license. And then if you fall under that to the, I think it's, I could look it up real quick. So they dropped the 1960 B1B and then recharged under 1960 B1C. 1960 B1C states that if you are a money service business, and if you're a money service business, you need to do things like KYC and AML. And so if you are a money service business and they still is knowingly transacting, I think it's transmitting funds from criminal offenses or otherwise used to support unlawful activity, then it's an additional charge that they can file against you. But, and the law is supposed to be written for a person of average intelligence to be able to understand. And if there's any ambiguity, it's supposed to fall in the defense's favor. So my understanding is if there's a subsection, then the top bracket must apply for then the subsection to apply. I think that's kind of common sense of hierarchical structures. They disagreed, and they charged a subsection when the previous section didn't apply. And that's how they got around, I guess, the Blanche memo. I don't see the logic.
Well, you know, Trump administration has really touted America as being the Bitcoin capital of the world, and this is not what the Bitcoin capital of the world would do to developers and innovators to have innovation here.
I do want to point out that there were other cases that at the time of the Blanche memo in other court districts outside of the SDNY that did drop cases. So they listened to the Blanche memo and said, okay, we're no longer going to prosecute people for the actions of their users. SDNY, there's two cases. There's also the Tornado Cash, which is an Ethereum protocol that they didn't drop theirs and they didn't drop ours. And they did this kind of switcheroo with you know, charges. So
they didn't some people one, did. Right? I think that's another one we have to pick up the torch on, because the fight for freedom is real and it affects it, wherever it is. That's where we have to defend freedom and privacy, the right for privacy and custody, self-custody. And then they seized Bitcoin, I guess, as part of the deal.
But just because, yeah, if you have proper, I guess, Bitcoin hygiene, then they couldn't seize it. They did have to send the prosecution the Bitcoin. Originally, they had actually asked, they wanted it in fiat, but there was just under 6.4 million. We had no way to get that. So finally, they relented and agreed to accept it in Bitcoin. But in the writing, and I think this is where you're going with this, and when they sent it over, it stated that they were going to be selling it, which again ignores another of President Trump's executive orders, because this money, it was a clean forfeiture, meaning there's no injured parties that were waiting restitution, like there would be if this was, you know, scan, if there was a victim or something, money couldn't go directly to the strategic Bitcoin reserve in that case. But as this was a clean forfeiture, they were supposed to, under the executive order, this Bitcoin would have been part of that strategic Bitcoin reserve. Actually, I think it may have been the first. I'm not sure about that, but that's not what they did.
Wow. And so there's like no victims here. We don't need to go into the details here, but you can listen to my conversation with Keone and you can look up for yourselves if you're listening. But the fine was egregious. The fact that they're selling the Bitcoin is going against Trump administration policy, which that has its own maybe flaws. But, this is just terrible and unfortunate. This is brave of you to step into the public eye to support your husband. And it's supporting all of us in the fight for privacy and financial freedom. Because if the way things are going, this is a slippery slope to us not being able to vote with our money. And that might be even like, it really might affect real voting and politicking. And even if you don't want to be in politics, it might affect how you're able to acquire goods and what you can buy and sell and trade with everybody, including your neighbors.
Yeah, it's on the way to being a social credit system, right? Like China is.
100%.
In a lot of ways.
And something to point out here, I think that I learned through this or relearned, or, you know, or you remember, but just sort of the difference when people think about sort of black and gray and white markets. I mean, if you sell an apple pie to your neighbor, that's a black market sale. And this is right. And so there's nothing wrong with black markets. And I'm not a fan of KYC and AML as it stands. So
too many people have been hurt by, poor storage practices of that data. That's very valuable data that unfortunately has been breached and caused a lot of harm. And on top of that, I think if, you know, the research that's been done into it hasn't really stopped money laundering, right? Some of the largest money launderers are banks that do all those kind of checks. So
yeah. So I want to thank you again. Your time is very precious, and anything we could do to get the word out. The raid on your home was a terrifying experience. I mean, this involved armed agents. Keone and Bill were operating within legal guidelines. The DOJ's actions I think this is politically motivated. I think this is scary as an American citizen and an affront on financial freedom. But it's also just a misallocation of resources against innocent American entrepreneurs while there's tremendous fraud in the country. And privacy and financial transactions is a critical issue in today's society. So, you know, the community support is vital, and it's even more vital going forward. So I hope people click on the links, sign the petition, donate what you can. And I'll leave it to you for any parting words and let people, again, just remind people where they can find you and kind of get involved.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for having me on and giving me the chance to talk. Hopefully I did Keone some good. He's definitely the better speaker of the two of us. But so I just want to thank you first. And yeah, people just, you know, please sign and keep continuing to get the message out. I know I'm sure it seems probably annoying to see it over and over again, but, you know, eventually if we're loud enough, you know, the right people will hear and you know, hopefully grant us a pardon. As far as finding me, I mentioned earlier, I didn't do social media before this. And so when I set up my X account, I didn't really ever do it for a handle that would be easily searchable. It was never the intent. So maybe you could link that below. And so people could follow me there. And, you know, this is kind of all I post about. Also follow at Keone, KEONNE. And that's, there's an intra-prison kind of email system. It's very delayed, very, you know, looks like it's from the early 2000s. but he sends me things and I just copy and paste them over that he wants posted. So anything coming from there, they are his words. So I'm just actually clicking post so they can follow him. And then, like you said, the rage, there'll be more articles and they are, I think they're quite entertaining and kind of funny. I think he's a good writer. Thank you very much.
We'll drop those links and people can write to him. They can read his letters. This is an obvious weaponization of the law. And, you know, one thing I'll just end on, it was President Trump mentioned Keone when a reporter asked about Keone. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just tremendously optimistic. It seems like it's on his radar, or at least someone over there hopefully jotted it down. And hopefully we'll hear soon and this nightmare will end. So thank you so much. We'll continue to do everything we can. Please remember, every signature does matter. Even Ross's mom, Lynn Ulbrich, mentioned that. I think you guys are close or above 15,000 signatures. And that's a meaningful number, but we got to get this up to hundreds of thousands. But we are, I think, at a faster start pace than Ross's team was at. But that doesn't mean we need to let up. We got to go like 10x harder. So hopefully next time we chat, we'll be at 100,000 and he'll be free way before that, though. But thank you so much. Well,
thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bitcoin Matrix. If you enjoyed the conversation, don't forget to like, subscribe, and drop a comment below with any questions or thoughts you may have. We'd love to hear from you. You can support the show by checking out our sponsors and affiliate links in the description. It helps keep bringing you great content while connecting you with awesome products that I believe in. Share this episode with your friends, family, or anyone curious about Bitcoin. And let's keep growing this community together. Stay curious, keep stacking, and I'll catch you in the next one.